Buongiorno, benvenuti a questa ultima giornata di Biennale Tecnologia, oggi domenica 15 novembre. E sono Juan Carlos De Martin, docente al Politecnico di Torino, nonché curatore insieme a Luca De Biase di questa manifestazione. E sono particolarmente contento di dare il benvenuto all'ospite che ci si collega con noi da Singapore, per tanti motivi. Beh, il primo motivo più diretto e più personale è che conosco la professoressa Malavika Jayaram da molti anni, anche per la comune frequentazione del Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society dell'Università di Harvard, dove lei è affiliata. E quindi è un piacere dare il benvenuto, avremmo voluto averla qui a Torino con noi come tutti gli altri ospiti internazionali, ma purtroppo dobbiamo accontentarci di un collegamento da remoto. Hello.
Hello.
Quindi un grande piacere personale, però al di là del piacere personale c'è anche l'orgoglio di dare il benvenuto a un ospite che è prestigioso perché oltre all'associazione con l'Università di Harvard è anche professoressa alla Facoltà di Legge della SMU di Singapore. Si occupa da un punto di vista giuridico di tecnologia digitale da molti anni. E quindi porta una prospettiva che, pur basata sulla legge, è stata capace di sviluppare una grande capacità di interagire con tecnologie e con altre forme di sapere, che è esattamente la cifra di questa manifestazione. Tanto per darvi un'idea, è stato il docente del primo corso in India in Information Technology and Law, quindi su, potremmo dire, digitale e legge nel 1997. E dopodiché ha insegnato a Chicago, fa parte di numerosi consigli consultivi come quello dell'Electronic Privacy Information Center, del Tech Policy Fellowship di Mozilla, collabora con l'IEEE, che tra l'altro è un istituto di ingegneri di cui faccio parte anch'io, sull'etica dei sistemi autonomi intelligenti, e numerose altre collaborazioni con istituzioni prestigiose come Chatham House e come l'OCSE. Quindi una persona di straordinaria competenza. E infine, ultima cosa che voglio dirvi prima di dare la parola a lei, è che la professoressa Jayaram è stata il direttore esecutivo inaugurale del Digital Asia Hub, un think tank indipendente con sede a Hong Kong, incubato dal Beckman Klein Center che ho già citato dell'Università di Harvard, che è un'iniziativa ambiziosa per riflettere sul rapporto tra tecnologie digitali e società, basata appunto in una città particolare importante come Hong Kong. E lei infatti verrà a parlarci in questi prossimi 40 minuti, verrà a parlarci di un punto di vista particolare, cioè il punto di vista di qualcuno che da molti anni è un ponte tra Stati Uniti, Europa e vari paesi asiatici, dal suo paese di origine che è l'India, ma appunto la Cina, Hong Kong, Singapore e così via. E quindi porterà a questa biennale è una prospettiva molto importante, ovvero una prospettiva che ci invita a ricordarci che in questo momento, quando parliamo di tecnologia, sia digitale ma altri tipi di tecnologia, il baricentro del mondo si sta spostando, forse si è addirittura già spostato. Ovvero è un baricentro che è basato sempre di più sulla Cina, sulla Corea, sul Giappone, su Singapore, la Malesia, la Thailandia, l'India. E quindi da questo punto di vista abbiamo assolutamente bisogno di qualcuno che innanzitutto ci lo ricordi questo fatto e poi ci aiuti a relazionarci con questo cambiamento epocale della storia del mondo e a capire in che modo anche dialogare con culture differenti quando parliamo di tecnologie digitali e società. Quindi con grandissimo piacere che do il benvenuto alla professoressa Jayaram, la ringrazio di aver accettato di collegarsi con noi e a lei il microfono.
Thank you so much for having me here today. I made a mistake. I thought my session was in 5 hours, and I think that's a really great starting point for this talk. Time zones have turned out to be a very fascist device. Those of us who live in certain parts of the world are actually doing calls in the middle of the night, at really crazy hours of the morning. And our head is somewhere between many time zones. And I think the reason that a lot of people do talks at these weird hours is because we're doing a lot of the emotional labor towards keeping places diverse and inclusive. This is something that we have always done. It's something that we did by flying to places, by standing in line to get visas, by going through a lot of bureaucratic processes, by going through extremely discriminatory racist processes at airports, in order to be in spaces and to get a seat at the table where policy was being made, where legal instruments were being discussed, where universal norms were being shaped. And we often went to places that were very far away from where we live, that were very alien to our cultures, and that actually to do a 20-minute talk at somewhere like the United Nations, we would prepare for a little while, we would fly for about 18 hours, we would fly back for 18 hours, we would deal with an insane amount of jet lag, we'd lose work. So every 20-minute talk was really a one-week commitment out of our lives. But we did this because we saw it as part of our service to academia and part of our interest in the public and in civic technologies to be able to show and to dissect and to unpack the fact that, in the words of Chimamanda Adichie, the really famous Nigerian-American author, the danger of a single narrative. And I think a lot of us take on this emotional labor, often in an unpaid way, because we feel that without us participating, we would merely be seen as passive recipients of development. We would be target audiences. We would be the new markets where Western technologies and tools would be implemented and deployed, but we wouldn't have an active role in actually shaping how these are designed. And we've seen through all of the crises, whether it's financial crises where people have said that if we had more women working in financial services, perhaps their approach to risk would have been extremely different, but also in the way that social media and platforms are designed and run, there's now an emerging consensus that having a very homogenous, very Silicon Valley set of teams and people that are actually designing the protocols and the defaults that govern a lot of the platforms that are universal and that people across the world use, we begin to see the fault lines and the cracks when these spaces are not more diverse. And I think now with movements like Black Lives Matter and so many other social movements, whether it's the climate change movement, whether it's around inequality, around gig work, around hate speech online, we're increasingly seeing the limits of having a single narrative and of viewing the rest of the world as if it was a homogeneous monolith. Usually when you think of, for example, from a legal perspective, take for example, privacy law, there is a sense that there is a European way of looking at privacy and data protection. There is an American way, which is, of course, exceptional and completely different. And there might be sometimes a nod to the rest of the world. But it seems to ignore the fact that the rest of the world contains multitudes. It contains universes of people that don't think, behave, look the same way. China has a completely different model for how the internet is shaped and governed. New Zealand might have a completely different approach to contact tracing apps. Singapore might have a very different one. And India might have a different one because of the population. And to see the rest of the world as if it's something on a drop-down menu where you can shop for the US, you can shop for the UK, you can shop for particular European countries. And then there's the rest of the world tag where we have to actually apply an email. We can't automatically purchase things online. We have to write and request a quote because we're completely different. We're not on anybody's radar, and we're seen and clubbed as something that's common, even though we're actually completely different. And to actually unpack this idea of the rest of the world not being a monolith and that being an extremely dangerous way of approaching law, policy, and governance, I wanted to share a few sort of practical examples. I'm often asked to speak at events, and a couple of years ago, someone reached out to me and asked about my availability for an event. And when I checked my calendar and I confirmed that I was in fact available, this person who I really want to give the benefit of the doubt, and I assumed they were doing this with the best of intentions, and I think they were quite junior and young, they were very excited and they said, "Oh my God, that's so exciting that you're able to participate on this panel because you're female and Asian." You know, and usually people might be ticking the boxes to do and perform diversity, but they're usually not this explicit. They try and tell you that it's because of your expertise, it's because they really liked your article on X or Y, it's because they appreciate your perspective on a particular theme. They usually don't say, "We want you because you're female and Asian." So I tried to see it with a sense of humor, but I did want to make a point about this sort of box-ticking exercise. So I very deliberately said, "Yeah, and you know, would you like me to also be lesbian for the day? And perhaps I could try having a disability as well. And you know, maybe I could trip on my way to the event and hurt my leg. Would that help?" And instead of seeing the irony in my question, this person was super excited and said, "Oh my God, are you? Are you queer?" And I offer this as an example for how the more of these criteria and boxes that people are able to tick, the better their event is, the better the space is, and the better the venue is. I'll offer you a second example, which is someone called Richard Lee in New Zealand was trying to upload his passport photograph in order to renew his driver's license. He kept trying to renew it, and every time he tried to upload the photograph, it kept rejecting it and saying that the picture was not valid. And the reason that the platform gave, the digital platform gave, was the subject's eyes are closed. Richard Lee's eyes were not closed. Richard Lee just happened to be of Chinese origin. He was of Asian origin. And the algorithm decided that he looked like he was sleeping rather than looked like he was Asian. And this is another example of how when platforms are not used to inclusion and diversity, in this case, an algorithm hasn't had access to the kinds of data sets that allow it to be trained for the machine learning system to understand what the full spectrum of data might look like. If it's been trained predominantly on people that look Caucasian, on people that look a certain way, anyone who looks slightly different is going to be flagged as an outlier. So Richard Lee, in this case, was flagged as being asleep because clearly this data set had more images of sleeping people than it did of Asians. The third example that I'll give you is Joy Bolamwini has done fantastic work. When she was a PhD student at the MIT Media Lab, she created a project called Gender Shades. And she talked about the weirdness of actually being recognized due to her darker skin color. A lot of the facial recognition algorithms simply didn't see her. She was invisible. And you've probably seen all those pictures where when someone's face is recognized by an algorithm, you have all of these different data points that are then connected by lines. And you have this topography of the face, which helps the system to match against its existing database. Joy's face did not even register. Joy's face didn't show up as anything until, as a joke, she picked up something that will be familiar to a lot of you in this call, something that looks like a Venetian mask that you would wear to a ball. So she picked up a white mask, put it on her face. Immediately, the algorithm actually recognized the points, and it recognized her as a face, as a human. So it took her wearing an artificial mask to be recognized as a real human because the algorithm hadn't been exposed to different skin shades and different gender, and therefore misgendered and misrecognized her and wouldn't even acknowledge her as existing. So these are three examples that I wanted to share with you as very real examples of a world where we're trying very hard to see, read, and render the world meaningful. We're trying through systems that increasingly mediate our interactions, whether it's the news, whether it's shopping, whether it's mobility, whether it's the rights that we're allowed to have and express online. These systems are increasingly algorithmically generated and shaped. And if certain of us don't even exist, if we're not valid, if we're not legitimate on these platforms, that's actually paying lip service to the idea of inclusion without actually allowing us to be included in these spaces. And this raises a really interesting paradox. On one hand, a lot of us have spent a lot of our activist lives and our academic lives in protesting the rise of ubiquitous surveillance. We're extremely concerned about the fact that there is very, very little privacy left in the world. There are very few spaces, whether it's spatially, temporally, intellectually, where everything we do and say and think is not tracked and stored and used to render certain types of meaning. So it raises this paradox where on the one hand, we're trying to stay under the radar and we don't want to be recognized by systems that want to use our data as part of the surveillance capitalist infrastructure or as something that will be used to make decisions about us that could prejudice us. It could mean that our social media behavior could make a very real financial decision about we're eligible for a loan. It could make a call about whether we're trustworthy, whether we're risk averse, or whether we're risky. And if these kinds of systems that we've been trying very hard to push away from are now in a stage where they also don't recognize us, we are left in this very awkward paradox where in some instances we want to be seen and included, and in other instances we don't want to be seen and we want to be left alone. And yet it's the same platforms that are now in this weird position of having to do both. People often tell me that it's very strange to hear somebody of Indian origin be known for talking about privacy and biometrics and data as being a bad thing because they're so used to this very flat narrative that Asians don't care about privacy. They assume all of Asia looks, sounds, feels, and thinks the same, and they make very glib, reductive statements about the fact that Asians don't care about privacy. And I found that it wasn't just Western audiences that were saying this. It was people in Asia who had also adopted this narrative from the West and were using it as a badge of honor, saying, oh yeah, actually, we don't care about privacy. Excuse me. And I often realized when I moved back from living abroad to living in India, when people would tell me, why do you waste your time protesting about ID cards? Why do you waste your time worrying about identity and privacy? Why do you care about whether we'll all be tracked? Who cares if the government knows what movies I watch? Who cares if companies know where I go, if they log my data? They're not going to do anything evil with it. Why do you care so much? And we're Indians. Culturally, we live in joint families. We have very, very close societal ties. We think in terms of the family. And the idea of the individual as being the center of study and of interest, they often would tell me, was a very Enlightenment construct. It was a Western idea, not an Indian one. So why was I, someone of Indian origin, talking like a Western person? And I realized that rather than tell them about human rights, rather than tell them about the Universal Declaration, rather than explain to them about how certain norms and values are universal, I would actually use very, very simple questions to provoke them about their own life. I would say, do your parents know that you smoke? Do your parents know that you, a very devout Hindu, allegedly, eat beef when you're not in the house? Do they know you go to McDonald's and order a Big Mac, but at home you're pretending to be Hindu and eating vegetarian food? Or I would ask friends who I knew were dating, do your parents know that you're dating a Muslim? Do they know you're dating a Catholic person? Do they know you've had sex? Do they know you've touched another person before marriage? Do they know you've smoked weed and inhaled, and it wasn't for experimental purposes? At which point, everybody would turn around and go, oh my God, I would be excommunicated. I would lose my inheritance. My parents would disown me. I could not live in my house anymore. And so I would turn around and say, but that is a privacy interest. So this idea that Indians don't care about privacy is an extremely reductive, misplaced idea. And I use this as an example of showing you that often people say that human rights in a lot of these less developed countries are not as important, they're not as critical, and that they don't inform the shape and the design of platforms. And it's an incredibly hard argument to make, but I have found that when you think about the rest of the world and you use these reductive narratives, you're actually allowing platforms to pander to this and to actually lower the standards. So in the same instance where a Facebook or a Google, and I just use these as examples, not because I want to point fingers at any one particular company, I'm just using them as proxies. So usually a Facebook would say, we're a global company, we're incorporated in the US, we will transport Western norms wherever we are in the world because those are the norms that guide us, those are our corporate values, that's the jurisdiction in which we are registered, and that's what we will be governed by wherever we are in the world. But what we found working across Asia is in countries where it's easy to ignore health and safety, where it's easier to ignore labor rights, where it's easy to say you are not allowed to unionize and it's not illegal to do that, where you can ask all kinds of questions during a hiring process, during interviews. You're allowed to ask whether somebody is likely to get married and whether they want to have children, and use that as a ground to discriminate and say they're probably going to go away and ask for maternity leave, so we don't want to hire this person. There's nothing preventing it. So a lot of these companies will say, we're just complying with local law. We're doing whatever is allowed. But when something local raises the ceiling, they will lobby extremely heavily. If it's data localization, which costs them money and time and energy, they will protest against that kind of a regulation. But where the legal system actually allows them to lower the floor, they're extremely happy to do that kind of moral arbitrage and to allow local norms to govern, where otherwise they would be saying, oh, we're a Western company, we don't actually care about your local norms. And I use this to invite you to think about how this kind of cherry picking that happens is reflective of asymmetries, both of information and power, and of the different imbalances that apply when global companies try to do business in countries where norms might be very different from theirs. This is something that from an ethics perspective, I teach my students. We've been debating the merits of universal ethics versus moral relativism and when it's allowed, when context is relevant, when context shouldn't matter. And I keep coming back to this idea that when you think of the rest of the world, human rights have to be the bedrock because it's extremely hard to argue against their application. However they are rendered into local law, it's extremely hard morally to make a strong argument that they should not apply because a country is poor, that they should not apply because of a country's demographics, that they should not apply because you can buy your way out of it. Human rights are seen as something you cannot waive, as something you cannot sell, barter, or bargain in. And human rights are seen as the bare minimum that should be afforded to people simply by virtue of being human. not by virtue of any kinds of entitlement, of any kind of position or box or category that they fall into. A few years ago, the network of centers and the Berkman Klein Center hosted this absolutely wonderful event, which was run by the Institute of Technology and Society in Rio. It was held in Rio de Janeiro, and it was about artificial intelligence and inclusion. And when we were prompted to think about algorithmic accountability and questions of automation and platforms and how it affects not just Western economies, but the rest of the world, what drop-down menus could look like, what kinds of priming and nudges might take place, how you might actually use financial incentives to get people to part with their data, how the shape, the design, the affordances of a tool or platform might drive uptake, how the language in which a particular technology is depicted might actually have a very real influence on who gets to access it, how the medium through which a particular welfare or benefit is actually made available to demographics will affect whether they actually benefit from it or not. If people don't have cheap data plans, it doesn't matter what your platform looks like because they can't see it. If someone doesn't have a smartphone, if you have an extremely image-rich, content-heavy platform, they won't be able to access it before they run out of their data plan. If the platform is completely in English, you're going to be losing a large part of the population that might most benefit from this. And so when we were asking the kinds of questions that AI and automation provoke for the Global South in particular and for the rest of the world, we really sort of looked at first principles. We asked things like, with a lot of automation and algorithmic systems, the core focus is usually on optimization and efficiency. And these are extremely seductive ideas in economies that are used to decades of corruption, where they're used to bureaucracy not being their friend, and when they're used to bureaucracy being something that is structurally and actively discriminating against them. So if you have a system that tries to be efficient and that tries to optimize for that, it might fundamentally be at odds with the messiness and the plurality of the lives that these people lead, which actually is about including them, even if they don't quite fit the criteria. There is a very, very seductive narrative that mechanized automated systems should replace human beings because human beings can be corrupt, human beings can be bought, and human beings are extremely biased. In countries where they are used to the fascist operation of authoritarian regimes, they actually view computerization and digitization as a boon, not a curse. They look at AI bias as something that's going to be much more transparent and effective than anything that a human would do. They're used to justice being delayed, they're used to justice not affecting them, and they're used to being structurally disadvantaged all of the time. So if you tell them that instead of making your case to a human judge who might discriminate based on your skin color, your name, your caste, your religion, but instead here's a computerized system that will do it based on algorithmic machine learning systems, they're going to view this as fantastic. And if you tell them it doesn't quite work and it still has biases, they're not actually going to care because they still see that as an improvement over human biases. They have an almost naive idea that these kinds of systems are neutral. And the one sentence that if I never had to hear this again for the rest of my life, I would be very thrilled, is students, engineers, and technologists telling me technology is neutral, people are biased. People are fundamentally problematic, technology is always neutral. But as you might have heard through the rest of the Biennale and through other talks that people have given, technology can be inherently biased. The data that you use, the platforms, the shape, the design, the black box in which it functions, the values of the people that create these platforms, they all embed these values and bias into the technology, which then seep into the decisions that it makes. Some of the questions that we really strongly engaged with was, how can we create artificial intelligence and automation that can benefit those that have had the least to do with creating it? How can you drive a homegrown sector that actually answers these questions rather than relying on what a lot of people have called data colonization or algorithmic colonization, where in the same way that trade routes, slavery, and other forms of oppression have historically made decisions about people's lives, needs, thoughts, and desires, the idea now is that surveillance capitalism and digitized platforms are doing exactly the same, where people's data is harvested and used in the service of companies and platforms and purposes that are far away across the world. The value that is generated is exactly like we've seen in other oppressive systems, where you can describe it more in terms of extraction than anything more benevolent. We've often seen that there are ideas around data is the new oil, data is the new gold, data is the new whatever new nice thing that you want to call it, whatever cliche, please insert your favorite cliche here. But in a lot of my work, I've been trying to actually shift this frame and say, what if we thought of data as asbestos, something that was helpful, but then became toxic and had to be removed? What if we think of data as kryptonite, something that can actually cause allergies in certain people and take away their powers? What if we thought of data as an externality, something that imposes costs and effects and consequences on people on the penumbra and periphery, not at the center of its creation? What if you thought of it as something that has, that is radioactive, something that has a half-life which decays, where the utility of it decays over time? Would those actually allow us to be more responsible in the ways that we automate systems, especially in countries and regions in the rest of the world, where we might have less agency, where we might have legal vacuums, where we might have less governance and infrastructure, less legal norms that can actually provide safeguards and checks and balances? You might also know about how even the systems that look extremely shiny and new and extremely technologized and sophisticated are actually built on the backs of human labor, which is most often invisible. The bodies that support and do the labor of tagging content, who decide whether something is obscene or whether it's art, whether nudity is something that should be put in a museum or something that violates community standards and should be taken down. The labor that these people put in, often under extremely terrible conditions, it's almost like the battery chickens that we now no longer want. We want free-range eggs and free-range healthy chickens that have been running around and eating grass. If we could imagine spaces of work that are not cages, where people actually have mental health counseling and actually have a quality of life, where they're not looking at pornography all day to be able to tag data to help the machine learning algorithm do its job. If we fail to recognize that a lot of the work in keeping platforms safe for people in the rest of the world, in the West, are unequally and disproportionately visited on people in my part of the world, and that we're doing a lot of the heavy lifting and the labor without being adequately compensated and without being taken care of, I think we're going to be shifting in the same sense of externality in the quest towards digitization for Western economies. We're going to be outsourcing harm. We're going to be outsourcing mental health issues and technological addiction to parts of the world that are less sophisticated. Some of the other questions that I have in this space is, how can we revise university curricula? And I know this is a subject that is very dear to Juan Carlos's mind, who's been focusing a lot about the idea of the university. How do we build inclusion into the system, into universities and the workplace, such that they're not a bolt-on, they're not something you add at the end, like a spice, like, you know, the pepper or salt that you add to improve a dish after you finish cooking it, rather than something that's a key ingredient right up front. It shouldn't be something that after you've designed and built a tool or a platform or a gadget, that you then think, oh yeah, now we need to make this inclusive. Let's hire an ethics person or a new CEO or a new data privacy officer so that it looks like we care about debiasing and making these systems transparent. I think looking at how curricula in universities actually understand diversity and inclusion, and they understand the rest of the world impact of the tools that they develop in the same way that, you know, universities like MIT that have a history of building technology for the military industrial complex without actually caring about ethics back in the day, how they've now become very central to the idea of having to think about ethics in places like the Media Lab. They've had that shift. Companies are doing it initially because of ethics washing, because they have to do it for corporate social responsibility, and because people are demanding it, because we now live in a woke cancel culture where it's increasingly required of companies and of universities. But instead of all the courses where we keep saying everyone should learn how to code, what would a world look like where we said everyone needs to learn ethics? Every engineer, every technical person, every design person should learn about legal ethics before they're allowed to develop and deploy a product. Should we also, when we talk so much about inclusion, also talk about a right to be excluded? What does a world of opt-outs look like? What does it look like to say, I don't actually want to be a part of surveillance capitalism, I would like an alternative. I don't want an algorithm making a decision about my mortgage or my bank loan or my welfare. I would like that to be tagged for a human officer. I would like an A/B testing system where I get to see what an algorithmic decision looks like and what a human decision looks like, so I can see what the difference between these two things are. And finally, I think the two big elephants in the room in this space are, how do you actually benefit from the advantages of all of the amazing technological advances, which are based on size, which are based on scale, without concentrating power in big corporations? And how do we do this without thinking very deeply about the role of the state, without thinking about the political economy of data, and without thinking about how we rebalance power when it comes to the private sector, the governments and individuals, and how that kind of the map gets to shift and be redrawn to be more ethics preserving, to be more privacy aware, and to actually care about the needs and the wants of the rest of the world, and to stop seeing us as markets where we're untapped and we're extremely interesting from a financial perspective, but to actually see us as active participants who can shape and design tools and technologies, not just for ourselves, but for the rest of the world. China showing the way, payment systems, facial recognition, many systems are being developed. And those are examples of the good and the bad in this space. But I think until we all come together and think in terms of a pluriverse and think in terms of a shared public interest and the civic interest in technology, I feel the rest of the world will only be another little option on a drop-down menu that ceases to have agency, that ceases to have rights, and that will always remain on the periphery of the conversation rather than something that is central, essential, and human in this new age. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Malavika, for this amazing bounty of thoughts and ideas and pointers. I've taken so many notes that we probably Scusate, sto parlando in inglese, dovrei parlare in italiano, scusate. Ho preso appunti che potrebbero riempire una conversazione di 2 ore o forse di più, e sarebbe bellissimo poterlo fare e spero che avremo un'occasione di farlo in futuro. Provo soltanto a selezionare alcune delle cose che mi sono venute in mente sentendoti parlare. E la prima è che proprio la natura di questa manifestazione di Biennale, il motto è la tecnologia e umanità, nel senso che la tecnologia non è soltanto un prodotto degli esseri umani, è anche riflette tutte le contraddizioni dell'umanità. Quindi riflette gli aspetti positivi, il desiderio di contribuire alla società, come riflette anche il desiderio di dominare e di sfruttare. E più specificamente la tecnologia è una conseguenza della società in cui viviamo. E quindi si pone un tema che tu hai accennato politico, perché se vogliamo che la tecnologia sia veramente diversa, negli aspetti che critichiamo, dobbiamo pensare a come cambiare la società, perché quella è la radice, da cui discendono varie cose che abbiamo detto sulla tecnologia. Questo come commento generale della manifestazione in cui ci troviamo in questo momento. Un'osservazione, tu parlavi del cherry picking, cioè della globalizzazione, come queste multinazionali, a seconda del contesto, invochino le regole del paese di origine oppure approfittino di regole più lasche a livello locale. Ne approfitto per fare un'osservazione relativa all'Unione Europea, dove persino nell'Unione Europea, dove c'è una base legale su diversi aspetti comune, capita la stessa cosa. Quindi noi vediamo anche all'interno dell'Unione Europea, dove per alcuni ambiti come regole fiscali, diritti dei lavoratori, ci sono delle differenze che vengono sfruttate esattamente nel senso che dici tu, con paesi che di fatto agiscono come attrattori di investimenti stranieri, sfruttando proprio questa diseguaglianza. Lo dico anche per il nostro pubblico, che in larga parte è italiano e europeo. Ancora un commento: hai parlato di etica per ingegneri e quindi del fatto che gli humanities in generale possano avere un contributo. È qualcosa che, come tu sai, mi sta molto a cuore, che stiamo provando a fare anche qua al Politecnico di Torino. E aggiungerei anche ancora qualcos'altro che si collega a tutto il discorso che hai fatto, cioè che abbiamo veramente un grandissimo bisogno di cultura, dove per cultura intendo abbiamo le scienze naturali, abbiamo le scienze dell'artificiale, cioè la tecnologia. Abbiamo le scienze umane e sociali, e benissimo, aumentiamo il rapporto, ma poi proprio abbiamo bisogno di cultura inteso anche come arte. Abbiamo bisogno di una maggiore capacità di frequentare la musica, la letteratura di altri paesi, di altre civiltà, di altre culture, perché quello mi sembra un canale fondamentale, una specie di collante che porta tutto insieme. E ci permette di finalmente di mettere insieme la tecnologia, la legge, l'etica e così via, grazie a questo tessuto connettivo che è la cultura. Avrei moltissime altre cose da dire, ma lascio forse questi ultimi minuti. Intanto io guardo se ci sono delle domande che vengono dal pubblico. Grazie.
Yes, I'm really glad you brought up the point about how this also happens in Europe, because I think one thing I didn't mention was how you can actually have competitive advantage. And I think historically, competitive advantage has often pushed it lowered the ceiling, as I had said earlier. But I think we're also seeing now that companies like Apple, for example, they want to actually compete in offering privacy and seeing privacy as a feature, not a bug, and actually making that part of their brand and their USP to say that you come to us not, and you pay more because we will never sell your data. So we don't need to sell your data to subsidize our product, which a lot of other companies do. We will just sell you the phone and nothing else, right? And I think that kind of thinking is very, very I think it's on the ascent right now, where products and governments are also trying to vie with each other, not to push things to the floor, but to actually push it to the ceiling and to actually say, could we actually compete on human rights? Could we compete on privacy and actually see that as a way to minimize legal liability on one hand, to boost our brand and our reputation and to recover from scandals, and to actually increase the audience that we would reach otherwise, because increasingly people vote with their feet and they care about this. And especially in a culture where people are being much more thoughtful about what they spend their money on, either because they have less of it or because they're extremely worried about consumption and about the climate. If people are willing to spend more to not be tracked and surveilled, they will actually spend more for that. So that's something that I think is a really interesting trend. And your point about culture, I think, also is so wonderful, because in a lot of my work and my teaching, I find that if I only talk about law and norms, people kind of glaze over and they think, oh God, I don't want to listen to this clause or this section of the Constitution or of the, you know, FCC or this regulation or about GDPR. Everyone has GDPR fatigue. But I find if you actually talk to them about art, it is a real leveler, and people can actually feel emotionally moved, and they actually see things that they wouldn't see if you only talk to them about law. Some of my favorite projects, for example, is one of them is Unfit Bits, which was done by Surya Mattu, you know, where he did this project looking at how you could give people Fitbits as sort of their Christmas bonus. And employees don't really understand that companies are trying to be extremely paternalistic or neoliberal and pushing them to exercise and be healthy and to look at their data. And a lot of people say, oh, that's fine, because my company is interested in my welfare. And it's only the cynics and the lawyers who say, no, 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 they just want to make sure that you're not increasing their insurance premiums because of your terrible lifestyle. And so Surya Mattu in Unfit Bits created all these amazing tools where he used power drills and other kinds of mechanized things where your Fitbit would keep rotating as the drill moved. And so you would get certain number of steps, certain number of rotations without doing anything. So, for example, on their website of Unfit Bits, they say, free your fitness data from yourself and ensure insurance discounts. And it provides simple techniques for generating great fitness data, no matter what your lifestyle, right? And so this, I think, is really fascinating, because one, it gets people to think about, huh, how can I gamify and hack the system? How can I actually work around it? Which I think this idea of hacking or obfuscation is extremely powerful as a tool of resistance and dissent. But I think it also makes the idea of surveillance and the need for a workaround extremely visible and easy to grasp, even for people who don't think about technology very much. And another example is Hassan Ilahi, who did this amazing project called Tracking Transients, where, you know, he was an academic and an artist, and he traveled around the world. And after 9/11, his neighbors were very suspicious that his newspapers piled up, the bottles of milk piled up, and they said, this is a weird guy, he's brown, he's Muslim, he comes and goes at all times of day and night, he must be a terrorist. And the FBI brought him in for questioning, and he had something like 200 interviews with law enforcement before they said that, okay, he's really not a terrorist, he's just an academic who travels too much. And at that point, he created this artwork where he said, if you need me to be in contact with you all of the time and you want to track me, you guys are so terrible, you couldn't even stop 9/11, you couldn't even track so many other actual terrorist instances, I don't think you're going to do a good job, so let me track myself and I'll do a better job. So I think on one hand, he was making fun of how poor law enforcement can be when it comes to predictive policing, but he was also really making this extremely powerful point about how data can tell you anything you want it to, and how when you have a lot of data and you're deluged by data, it's very hard to find meaning. It's kind of the classic signal to noise problem. How do you look for a needle in a haystack? And he said, if he can't keep himself private, he can push so much data into the public domain that it's very hard to find any meaningful relations between those data sets. So he took a picture of every bathroom he used. So you'll see a lot of ceramic art on his website. He took a picture of every meal he had. He had timestamps, every room he stayed in, location data. And he really sort of took the piss out of this idea of tracking and said, you want to make some sense out of all of this data? Be my guest. Here it is. So I think a lot of these projects show you how surveillance takes place and how pointless it can be in a much more humorous and much more poignant way that I think resonates and makes this discourse much more mainstream and accessible rather than just living within academia or in a few articles that nobody will read. So yeah, thank you so much for bringing up the culture and the art point.
And let me mention that yesterday we were talking with Frank Pasquale, who was connected from Biennale. He was, I think, in Korea. And somebody in the audience was a teacher from, I think, middle school or high school. And so she said, your topics are a little too difficult, but please give me some suggestions about, di nuovo sto parlando inglese, qualche raccomandazione su cosa posso dare a dei bambini o dei ragazzi. E Frank Pasquale ha detto, ci ha pensato su, ha trovato una domanda molto interessante e ha detto, ha suggerito alcuni lavori di fantascienza come un ottimo strumento per iniziare a riflettere sulla tecnologia e ci ha anche consigliato alcuni romanzi di fantascienza come un mezzo per entrare e riflettere in maniera più attraente su questi temi e tra l'altro in alcuni casi anche in maniera più profonda perché la...
Yes, I completely agree with that. I think some of the best work comes out of fiction, it comes out of television. I think my students have learned more from Black Mirror than from any textbooks about surveillance. They've got to see how these are embedded in real life. And I think the genius of something like Black Mirror is it's just on the edge of what's possible and what's currently being done. It's not in some science fiction universe, you know, in the year 2060. It's like it could be happening 6 months from now. And I think that's extremely powerful. And I think fiction and art play a really, really big role in this. I think also there are really great tools made for kids nowadays. There's a wonderful project that Blakely Payne does where she creates these great tools for children to learn about algorithms. And this is wonderful for Italy. She says, make children write recipes for pizza and then compare the recipes to see what people thought of as ingredients and how they came to the recipe. And she says, a recipe is an algorithm, right? And it's a very great way of showing people that, of showing kids that there is no one right way to make pizza. And so there is no one right algorithm. It all gets to the same place, which is pizza, but the ingredients might be different, the process might be different, and it could be a black box, it could be transparent. But she says, if you think of algorithms as recipes for pizza, you start to teach children the idea that algorithms are opinions, they are not mathematical truth, and that they're very much embedded with the values and the preferences of different types of taste that people have for pizza or for anything else. So yeah, that's wonderful.
Purtroppo il tempo ci sta parlando di algoritmi, in questo caso un limite fisico della nostra piattaforma che abbiamo esattamente 60 minuti e non di più, per cui dobbiamo purtroppo avviarci alla conclusione. Ne approfitto solo per dire che un evento gemellato con Biennale Tecnologia che ha avuto luogo nei giorni precedenti al Biennale è stato un evento organizzato dalla Fondazione Gian Giacomo Feltrinelli e tra l'altro organizzato anche in parte dal Centro Nexa su Internet e Società, un evento dedicato esattamente al lavoro nascosto dietro alla intelligenza artificiale. L'evento si chiamava Unboxing AI dove abbiamo visto, seguito io personalmente, gli interventi molto interessanti su molti lavoratori in India che fanno questo tipo di lavoro di etichettatura del materiale che viene poi usato per fare l'addestramento. Quindi i video sono disponibili online e pubblico adesso su Twitter il link nel caso qualcuno fosse interessato. Bene, ciò detto, io ringrazio veramente di cuore l'amica, la professoressa Malavika Jayaram per il suo straordinario contributo. È sempre un piacere vederla. Speriamo la prossima volta di poterlo fare di persona, magari venendo noi a Singapore o a Hong Kong, molto volentieri. E quindi grazie ancora di aver dedicato un'ora a Biennale Tecnologia e a presto.
Thank you so much and have a great rest of the day. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye.